Recording live from the Hoban Law Group here in Denver, Colorado, I'm your host, Eric Singular. We're sitting alongside president and founder of the Hoban Law Group, Bob Hoban. Today we are talking about the rapidly evolving landscape of cannabis law, and we are joined by Sean Hawking, the founder of the Cannabis Law Report. Sean, how are you doing today?
I'm doing very well. I'm talking to you from Sydney, Australia, on a warm winter's day with people. I apologize if you have any background noise. They do love a leaf blower and a strimmer here in Australia. So everybody's out in their high-vis jackets making as much noise as possible. But otherwise, very well. Thank you.
Well, we thank you so much for coming on and joining us today on the Hoban Minute. And there's really nobody better to talk about this rapidly evolving landscape than yourself. You've been documenting this industry. You've been specifically the cannabis law sector now for a number of years. Tell us a little bit about the history of cannabis law, your intersection with all of this, and what you've seen.
Essentially, my background is in legal publishing for the last 30 years. Back in 2015, I moved from China, where I was living at the time, to Portland, Oregon, and noticed what was happening in the cannabis sector. So I thought, none of the bigger publishers or media people really will be interested in this for a couple of years. So I thought I'd just start reporting on it on a daily basis. And essentially, at the very beginning, I think I could find about 150 lawyers who dealt with cannabis in a sort of business sense at that time rather than criminal. And over the last 5 years now, we're almost at, I think on my database, I have up to about 17,000 who say that they are business-related cannabis lawyers, whether they be solo practitioners, small practice areas in SMEs, or the larger multinational and big national US firms creating full service cannabis practice teams across the country. So there's been a huge change, but as we're discussing this morning or today, there's obviously about to be another huge change in the industry as there's contraction across the economy generally.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit more. And so, you know, obviously you're referring to the outcome, the financial and economic implications of this coronavirus, and that simply there is going to be less companies on the other side of this thing than there were previously. What do you kind of predict as far as, how that landscape might change, how, what companies might stay, which companies might go in the months or years to come?
Well, I think in the months to come, we're going to see a rather large contraction in the industry, both from the very top end, then obviously from the supply side down to the small farmer who may have moved out of the grey area into regulated in various states, but I worry that they might be forced back into the grey area, because if we're looking at the top end of the sector, even the biggest, most financed companies are struggling desperately to keep their heads above water, both in Canada and the US, in terms of their share prices, in terms of them overhiring, overdoing everything, basically. If we talk in generalizations, there's probably, there were probably 20 large companies. I see that being reduced down to probably about 5, and you could use the same percentages all the way down through smaller and medium-sized producers, processors, retailing might be the only area that I don't think it will grow, but I think it probably will remain in the short term, but you'd probably see a contraction in that over the next 12 to 14 months as well. There's a lot of competing factors, but I do see you know, you'd hope there's only going to be a contraction of 30%, but I do think in the way that this industry has been financed over the last 5 years, we'd probably more likely see a contraction of about 60%.
Well, Sean, you've covered and been involved in many capacities, the legal industry worldwide for many, many years. And as you look at the evolution of legal services that support the so-called cannabis industry, you know, the industry that involves the marijuana side and the hemp side, there's some characteristics or perhaps stereotypes of where different sorts of lawyers come from. There are lawyers that come out of the criminal practice.
Well, over the years, you know, dub themselves cannabis lawyers, and then there's business lawyers, but can you expand on that, just some of the things you've observed?
Okay.
And, you know, seen a business opportunity coming out of dealing with criminal and those sorts of issues, and they saw the birth of the industry, and some of them moved not so successfully, and some of them more successfully into the business side of the sector. And yeah, you know, I'd say that specifically, you know, everybody would I think concur with this, that, you know, in states like Oregon, Washington, and Colorado first, that's where you saw most of those sorts of people, you know, build bigger practices based around the business of cannabis rather than the criminality of cannabis. And then as other, you know, states came in, and, you know, again, we're talking California, Nevada, now Illinois, you could see, and on the East Coast, as soon as people saw bigger companies coming out of the regulation in these smaller states, firstly, sort of SME, local state firms with maybe, you know, 80 or 90 partners, and they created a 5-7 partner practice based around, you know, the business of cannabis and subsequently hemp law. And over there were a few bigger firms who thought about national practices up to, you know, 18 months, 3 years ago. You know, immediately comes to mind a firm like Fox Rothschild, who seemed to be into that game earlier. But over the last 12 months, you'll find now that most big U.S. law firms, and then some of those multinationals, will have what they would describe as a full service practice, and essentially only one or two of them would be specialists in cannabis law, and then the rest of the that particular group. And some of them seem to have groups that imply they have up to 50 or 60 lawyers who can deal with cannabis issues, and they would be specialists drawn from other practices, you know, and all across the board, obviously, from IP related to obviously bringing companies to market, et cetera, et cetera. Whether those law firms have those practices in 4 or 5 months' time, or they just essentially become bankruptcy practices, who can say at the moment? The law firms, I've also reported and been in legal publishing now for 30-plus years, reporting on law firms. And one of the things I've been doing on another site that I run called PracticeSource.com, which is basically designed to provide information for legal information professionals around the world. If you're looking at what law firms are doing at the moment, and especially I concentrate here in Australia and in the UK as well as the US, I mean, they're contracting very fast, and they're not laying people off. They call it furloughing at the moment. But again, you're seeing a lot less work being done across a range of practices while they strengthen the sort of practices that are obviously going to do well as we come out of the other side of COVID-19. And I would see that in the bigger law firms with regard to cannabis, that they're going to, I would say, that these cannabis practices will probably become a much smaller version of what they were 3 or 4 months ago. And you know, as we're aware, the big dream for later this year was New York and New Jersey, and thus some of the other states on the East Coast actually bringing in some sort of regulation, that's now finished. I would suggest until at the very earliest, mid or late next year. So I think a lot of those firms will plan accordingly.
Well, Bob, I have a question for you, and the answer might be very obvious, but it's not. As we're talking about the history of cannabis law, it's not so obvious to me. Maybe it's not super obvious to our listeners. But you say, some of the first generation cannabis lawyers, they were criminal defense lawyers. Why is there a challenge in a criminal defense attorney coming over and trying to do the work of a commercial law firm such as Hoban Law Group? What is kind of the history for why, an HLG was so necessary to step into that place?
So, yeah, Eric, the idea that lawyers that practice in a specific area have nuanced ways that they look at things, experience in the procedure, understanding of how other practitioners in that practice area operate is really critical, particularly if you want to understand how to do things at a very, very high level. And there's a lot at stake in this industry. While lawyers could sit down and analyze a legal issue like any lawyer, to put that into practice and to deliver something, particularly in front of a court or something that's highly sophisticated, that nuance is lost. And after all, lawyers are not typically inexpensive. So you need to make sure that you get what you pay for, which is why that area of expertise is so critical. But, Sean, as we've looked at the evolution and the creation of the so-called cannabis attorney, we've seen firms in different places around the world initially look at cannabis as if it was a taboo, as if it were something that we shouldn't touch. It's not legal in the United States, or it may not be completely legal here or there. Therefore, we're going to stay away from that. But we've seen a dramatic turn in recent months, in recent year plus, towards, to your point, these larger firms coming in and literally overnight flipping on the lights and saying, we have a 60-person cannabis division. It begs the question as to whether or not these attorneys have ever done a particular cannabis deal or done a transaction in this environment. But that's almost besides the point. You've seen new industries take on legal services. How does this compare?
Well, I mean, it's very interesting you should say that, because I think a lot of these firms, they had one or two individuals who have been pushing that this could be a new practice area for them, and they quietly did some work. But what was interesting at the time when I was reporting, if I asked them whether they were doing that work, well, you wouldn't get a yes and you wouldn't get a no. Generally, you wouldn't get an answer at all, even though you knew they were working on deals. So they were, for a good period of time, they were almost embarrassed to mention that they had been working on a cannabis deal. I think a lot of that had to do, obviously this is in the US I'm talking about more than anywhere else, because there's hardly any firms still working in cannabis outside the US, or they're in the same stage that the US was a few years ago. So as you say, without a doubt, most of those practices and the individuals, whether they be a partner or an associate or a senior associate, they normally like to put up for the cannabis work. It'd be highly unlikely that they would have actually done much cannabis or any cannabis work whatsoever until it was sent down from the partner who'd been quietly working and developing business relationships for the prior 12 months before they actually announced that they had a practice. I, as you well know, big law firms are quite difficult organizations to communicate with, in terms of if you're trying to get real information out of them, just like any large corporation, it's what they want to tell you is only what you find out. So, I think even at this stage of the proceedings, you'll find most of the big law firms on the East Coast. I wouldn't say so much the West Coast, because they have been working in the area for up to 10 or 12 years previously with sort of informal medical cannabis work. But I would say, most of the people on the East Coast, and if you went over to London where there's two or three firms who say that they deal in cannabis, most of the lawyers, or most of the practitioners, I should say, wouldn't have actually done any cannabis work. up till 6, 7, or 8 months ago. It's a very recent thing. And that's what's interesting going forward, because they have spent all this energy creating these inverted commas cannabis practices, and they may, those cannabis practices may not exist or be a very slim version of what they were in July, August this year.
Well, so in Australia, there's been recent policy action that has set the foundation for a medical marijuana discussion. There's also been a number of high-profile hemp or CBD companies that are based out of Australia. Elixinol comes to mind in particular, but not limited to Elixinol. So can you talk a little bit about, let's start with, how has the practice of law, to your observation, evolved in terms of who and what offers services in Australia, and what is the future for cannabis regulation in Australia?
Well, that's a very, very interesting question, because to answer your first point, with Australia and law firms, we are where we were in the US in about 2016, 2017. So we've got two or three practitioners who say that they practice in cannabis law, and they like to keep pretty quiet about it, essentially to keep an almost information monopoly on the sort of service that they provide out to customers. So they won't be very public about the work that they do. As far as I'm aware, there is yet to be an Australian law firm who will declare publicly that they have a multifaceted cannabis practice. That said, I'm sure if you run a company in the US and you wanted to work with Australia, and you made a couple of phone calls to some of the bigger Australian law firms or a multinational, they would try and help you. But in terms of if I went and asked for lawyers to write for me at this particular time in Australia on a number of issues, I wouldn't get a response. Now, this is very interesting, as you say, because Australia actually has a pretty sophisticated way of approaching medical cannabis legislation and regulation, both at a state and a federal level. And a lot of work has been done, and there was recently another look at a Senate commission on what has been done and what needed to be improved to make sure that people could access medical cannabis in a far better way than they had previously. And that report came out about three, four weeks ago now. And, it's very detailed, and there's both an industry, a R&D industry, and a very tightly controlled and regulated medical cannabis industry, which is, if anybody knows Australia, is the way that this country is run, is that they love a regulation, and they like to spend a lot of time preparing those regulations and before they put them into action. So I don't, for Australia, it'll be a while yet before there's, it is the size of one US state. So whether the market will ever be big enough to carry a number of law firms competing with one another to do work on medical cannabis business in this country is still a bit of an open question. Australia is very unlikely to regulate adult use or recreational marijuana I would say the next 10 years. I could, in the times that we live in, I could be completely wrong, and that argument could be turned on its head because they need tax dollars. But I find it very, very unlikely that that will happen in the current political and regulatory environment. So I think a lot of the work that that companies who are from the US or Canada are doing here at the moment are limited to very few lawyers who work very quietly and just work with their clients and keep that to themselves.
Sean, I want to ask you, you have a large network of stakeholders and a big audience, especially with cannabis law. What are the issues that you have seen people really care about in the last month with COVID-19? Are there articles that are, you know, getting more readership? What do you think people are really looking for right now as far as information related to cannabis law and how they're being impacted by this pandemic?
I think people across the board just want more information about the industry. Obviously, what a lot of people seem to be, you know, unsurprisingly, are interested in are which of the really big listed companies are going to see their way through this whole process. As their share prices were tumbling before this in both Toronto and on the New York exchanges. And I think that's really what people are looking at most closely in terms of the traffic that I'm seeing to the stories, is how are these people going to fare, because they essentially will be the canaries in the coal mine with regard to how the rest of the industry is going to do on a national level. There's a lot of employment issue interest as well. Again, that's unsurprising, because a lot of these companies have had to let go or furlough, but essentially in this industry they've let them go between 30% and 40% of their workforce within a matter of days, and of course that reflects the wider economy anyway. But I think different to the wider economy, for medium-sized companies and the large ones, there's very little option that these people are going to be rehired again, that they're going to be, you know, these companies will have to be tighter, smarter ships to sail, essentially. Those are the two main areas I'm seeing people looking at the moment in terms of the stories. Otherwise, people are just obviously looking at general information to get a sense of what might happen. The other thing is there's so much conflicting information, because obviously a lot of the information coming out of the industry at the moment is fed by PR and marketing people for various organizations, companies, etc., selling up the idea that everything's going to be fine, and the reality is otherwise. And I think we really need to wait 8 weeks before we see all that wash out and we actually see a reality of what's happening in the sector as people hopefully start going back to work.
Oh, that's a great point. And it certainly does take a lot to filter past the noise. That's why we celebrate the work that you do.
And that's right. I mean, I think an important thing to remember is, a lot of the money raised in this sector are from, they're not institutional investors, they're private investors. And so those private investors, obviously, they're taking a big wash at the moment. And where is their money going to go when we come out of the other side? And will they think cannabis is safe? And at the moment, I believe that they don't. And money will probably start being redirected into areas of the economy that obviously they see a bit of safety and growth, and not looking for really quick returns. Cannabis isn't that sector. So I tend to not have the same overall positive view of how the sector is going to do going forward to many people, because it's a fact of having to be a bit more realistic. And then I think you can plan better if you're realistic rather than hoping for the best.
Well, we certainly appreciate that cautious perspective. It's definitely an important one to share. And, I'm sure in the time between when we talk to you next, the cannabis law landscape and the cannabis landscape in general is going to evolve. It seems to just keep evolving every single day, especially in the wake of this pandemic. Sean, thank you so much for taking the time to be here with us today, and stay safe down in Australia, my friend.
Thanks, Sean.
Thank you very much indeed. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of the Hoban Minute special series on coronavirus and cannabis. You can head on over to hoban.law for more information on this podcast or the Hoban Law Group. If you have any ideas for subjects that we should be covering or any questions you want to pose to Bob or myself, shoot us an email at media@hoban.law. Stay tuned for the next episode on this special series, Coronavirus and Cannabis.